The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Light out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And we are not joined by Danny today. He is, he had a wedding he went to this weekend. So he needed a day to recover.
Fair.
Which rightfully so. You know, sometimes you get a little lit.
I've been those there. Parties. Yeah.
So Danny's not here. However, Tom is here. And you may have seen Tom before. He's stepped in for Danny in the past. He's also one of our producers over on my other show, Mile Higher. Go check that out if you haven't. But today we've got a very, very creepy episode for you. Some real-life horror stories from one of the scariest places you could possibly end up on this planet. Prison.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I actually have a very legitimate fear of prison.
I think we all should, yeah. Especially in the U.S. It is not a fun place to be.
I mean, I can't tell you how many hours I've spent over the years watching prison shows.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like Locked Up Raw. I've watched all the 60 Days In. There's a new one on Netflix called Unlocked, which was kind of like an experiment show, which was kind of interesting because they took a bunch of inmates that are usually locked up 23 hours a day and like let them... basically have like time outside the cells where they could go in and out of their cells whenever they wanted to, and that was pretty interesting to see if they could like handle it and if they would like be able to like manage themselves and like keep it under control.
Yeah.
Don't want to give any spoiler alerts, but kind of went exactly how you would think it'd go.
Right. I mean, I have a lot of feelings about solitary confinement. I think if you subject anyone to 23 hours in a cell by themselves, that I wouldn't know what to do with myself if I was all of a sudden free. There's a lot to unpack there.
I mean, lucky for you, you like to read.
I would be. So. I swear to God. I mean, I know that I'm not trying to make light of prison, but I think a part of me would thrive. I'd be like, I can finally just read a million books and write a novel. And everyone can just finally shut the hell up.
That's if you're Selly. Less
true.
You.
Yeah, true.
Like maybe solitary. Yeah, if you were solitary, yeah, you'd probably do better than most, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of guys are, you know, with somebody.
Yeah,
for those
true.
23 hours a day.
Yeah. And I would not work well with a highly social roommate, I don't think. That would get old fast.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many horror stories from prison. Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy, some of the stuff that you hear.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous place.
On the flip side, there are like lower security prisons, medium security prisons. I've brought this up on the show before. There's a great podcast called Ear Hustle, which kind of demystifies how we see prison as this like just horror space, right?
They're not all like that.
Yeah. Sometimes they're reading books, they're playing D&D, like... There are certain prisons who, you know, maybe nonviolent offenders, get access to a bit more resources. They're running the podcast from prison too, so it's cool to see that. But yeah, our stories today
don't deal with those types of prisons.
Yeah,
at all.
No. And if these prisons once started as a place of rehabilitation, they quickly abandoned that thought and moved to a much scarier prison system.
A horror farm is the term I always use.
The horror farm, yeah.
I mean, take a place that's already scary, like prison, and then add a whole paranormal element to it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes sense. Out of all the places on this planet that you would think would have paranormal activity, prisons make sense to me.
It does.
I mean, just from the sheer amount of horrifying things that go on there. I mean, the types of people that are there, oftentimes some of the most evil individuals.
Yeah.
And so you kind of couple that together and makes a lot of sense to me why we have a lot of haunted prisons. Today, we're going to be taking a look at two of them, the Ohio State Reformatory and the West Virginia State Penitentiary, which are no longer being used as prisons, but they were for a very, very long time. And some of the stories that we'll be talking about today are truly scary. And be thankful that you never had to experience some of the things that went on in these places. So let's go ahead and take a look at the Ohio State Reformatory. And so we're going to go all the way back to the beginning of this prison. And this prison from the outside the way that they used to build these prisons too. Like really cool architecture, the Gothic architecture.
I feel like across the board in the 1800s, we just had better architecture for everything. We actually just cared about how buildings
looked. Yeah, what happened to that? Why did our architecture change?
What happened?
I'm so tired of seeing all glass, all white buildings.
Same. Modern architecture hurts me.
It hurts me too. I don't like it.
Me neither.
And people are like obsessed with it. This like minimalist, clean, all white.
No soul.
No, yeah. There's no
it's
like.
A godless. It's a godless place.
It looks like a sterile place. If
yes,
you ask me.
It's a hospital.
Yeah. That's the exact vibe I get when I see that. So I love this Gothic Baroque sort of look. I don't know if I'd want to be in a Gothic prison, but. At least it looks cool on the outside.
True.
The inside's a little bit different, but the Ohio State Reformatory, also known as the Mansfield Reformatory, or just OSR, which we'll be referring to it as OSR to save some breath here, opened on September 15th, 1896 in Mansfield, Ohio. OSR would operate for about a century. That's a long time, about 100 years. And in that time, it quickly gained the reputation of being one of the most brutal prisons in the United States. Not to mention the most haunted prison. In the late 1800s, the city raised $10,000 and purchased 30 acres of land to construct the OSR. Built on Civil War training grounds, the prison was still under construction when it first opened its doors, welcoming its first 150 prisoners in 1896. They were transported by train from Columbus, and they were immediately put to work to finish the prison sewer system. It's like, oh, welcome to prison. How about you build your own sewage system? As well as the 25-foot wall that surrounded the complex. It would take another 14 years to finish the rest of the prison, often using the labor of inmates. So the main building of the complex is 250,000 square feet.
I can't even comprehend how big that is.
Just go look at an Amazon warehouse.
That's basically it.
And they're probably bigger, honestly.
Yeah.
But that's huge for
prison.
Yeah. The 6-story E cell block alone contains 600 cells. Each cell is about 7 by 9 feet. That is not very big.
No.
I mean, that's like, I think some people's walk-in closets these days are bigger than 7 by 9 feet.
Is that, that's...
This room's bigger than that.
Yeah.
Because I think this room's like 11 by 14 or 12 by 14.
Yeah.
Or even 12 by 16, maybe.
And a lot of people who watch us don't really have a concept of how big this room is, because obviously you're only seeing this side.
Probably seems huge on camera.
Right, yeah. It's not. It's pretty
really
small
not.
In here. It's cozy.
No, we're constantly like almost tripping over our equipment and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's bigger than 7 by 9 cell.
Yeah. Josh keeps me here. I have to sleep on a cot right here, and he locks the door when he leaves.
Yeah, so. And I slide no food under the door.
No food.
MREs is all you get. But upon the prison's completion, it became the largest freestanding steel cell block in the world. Its architecture was inspired by Victorian Gothic. I love Victorian Gothic. I'd love to have a Victorian Gothic house.
That'd be awesome.
If they weren't like almost non-existent for one and a gajillion dollars if they are. And its Romanesque exterior looked similar to a castle system. It would even get the nickname Dracula's Castle. And the original builders were hoping to inspire some connection with God while the inmates served their time. It seems kind of contradictory to me. You know, Dracula's Castle and, well, we hope you find God here.
I know. And I think we'll see this recurring theme where it's like the intentions for a prison is not often what ends up happening. You know, they're like, this is where we're going to reform people.
And help them find God.
And that, yeah. And then it just turns into a nightmare that's Dracula's castle.
Yeah. Sounds about right. In its early days, the prison was meant for nonviolent first-time offenders. It was an intermediate penitentiary, a halfway point between the industrial school and the state penitentiary. They were offered religious instruction, education, and vocational training. If an inmate showed early signs of rehabilitation, they could be released. Those who did not were sometimes given an additional sentence. The prison included a school, a gym, industrial work training area, and of course, a chapel. Even though the conditions were generally better than the other prisons at the time, the OSR soon became overcrowded. Sometimes 3 to 4 inmates were placed in that 7 by 9 foot cell, basically stacking bodies at that point. The facilities also fell into disrepair, and on top of this, the prison was no longer exclusive to nonviolent first-time offenders, and the intermediary reformatory soon became a maximum security prison, which was the opposite of what it was originally built to be. So now with the population out of control and the conditions getting terrible by the minute, and of course more violent criminals being housed in close quarters, abuse from prison guards is obviously going to go up when you get these kinds of inmates in there. And for a place that prided itself as a reformatory that gave opportunities to its inmates, the prison soon fell into the old methods of horrible torture and abuse. As early as July 15th, 1898, the New York Times ran a small piece that shocked the nation. Inmates had gone on a strike over no longer having access to tobacco. As punishment, the prison officials suspended the inmates by their thumbs. How does that even work?
Right?
How do you suspend somebody by their thumbs? Do you know?
I would have no idea.
How do you do that?
You have to be a sick freak to know how to do that.
That's insane to me.
So oddly enough, I can actually give you a little bit of insight into that because there was a... I forget what the show was. I think it was Black Sails or something back when that was a thing. Basically, like it's exactly what it sounds like. You basically get really like high tensile string or something similar and wrap it around your thumbs.
Ugh.
And the thing is obviously your body weight just automatically disconnects it. So you wouldn't actually have like any sort of like muscle strength to really like try to give yourself any sort of leeway or try to like, you know, just give yourself any respite at all. So your thumbs would just disconnect. You would just kind of hang there. And then when you came back down and, you know, had to relocate your thumb, you would have like very minimal dexterity left and without, you know, immense physical therapy. So it was not only like short-term abuse, but long-term abuse because you basically would have to like...
Your hands like don't work
anymore. They were fucked. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's crazy.
Leave it to Tom to know about the reprehensible torture systems they have.
I read... I was going for anthropology at some point. I know a lot of random medieval history shit.
That is disgusting.
That's what this is, medieval torture.
Yeah.
Well, so not only are they suspended by their thumbs, but they were only allowed one meal a day, and I'm sure it was not a steak by any means. Probably some... cheap slop type food.
Mm-hmm.
And another form of punishment was local control, otherwise known as solitary confinement, or you've probably heard of this term before, the hole. Inmates could spend up to 72 hours here in complete darkness. Imagine that. That sounds horrible. I mean, you just go insane.
Right. This is a little bit of a sidetrack, but I think you'll find this interesting because you're a Lord of the Rings fan, and some of our listeners will be like, how are you going to connect this to Lord of the Rings? But Sean Astin, the guy who plays Samwise, talks about how he was talking about the creature Gollum and how obviously that's a metaphor for addiction. You can kind of break Gollum down into a few different categories. But one of his things where he thought one of the best lessons from Lord of the Rings is that when you treat someone with kindness and love, they will then in turn kind of give that back.
Bring that back to you over time.
Yeah. And when you treat something with disdain, which is often how Samwise treated Gollum, like get this creature away from me.
You get disdain back.
And so, yeah, right. Gollum didn't like him. But then Frodo would kind of extend an olive branch to Gollum here and there. And you would see that Gollum would treat Frodo a little bit better. So I always think of that when I think about solitary. It's like, what do we expect to happen to these individuals when we subject them to this horror?
That's a very good point. It's like, who came up with this idea, and how did they think this was going to make anything better whatsoever, right? Or even teach them a lesson? I mean, you're going to, and not only that, but you're going to put your entire prison at risk the more times you do this to somebody, because they're going to become mentally unstable if they're not already.
Right.
And so then you have somebody there that is now an even greater risk to the rest of the population and to the guards.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems like, it seems like for a long time, especially at the beginning, prisons were just a legal way to torture people.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder who these people were that ran these prisons.
Right.
And what kind of humans they were. Because, like, how could you
suspend people by their thumbs,
right,
lock people away in the dark for 72 hours?
Are you any better than the criminals themselves?
Right.
Like, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
There was one particular time due to overcrowding where two violent inmates were once placed in the same solitary cell, and only one emerged alive after killing the other and hiding the body of the deceased under the bunk bed. Reportedly, another inmate took his own life in solitary, and a guard was once shanked to death by an inmate who was subjected to solitary for several weeks straight. Rumor has it that others were subjected to torture in the sweat box, which was solitary confinement, but during the most hot in humid days of the year, there'd be little ventilation in the small room, and inmates experience extreme heat, dehydration, heat exhaustion, or if it got bad enough, death. I mean, what do you think's going to happen if, right, you do that? Another form of punishment was nicknamed the butterfly, which was an electrical device that shocked inmates, similar to an electric baton. Conditions became so terrible at OSR that 120 inmates rioted in 1957, and guards were eventually able to get things under control before anyone died, but countless inmates were thrown in a solitary confinement. Sometimes up to 10 men were placed in a single cell. Apparently, they weren't given food, sometimes for days, and many of the men began losing their minds.
I love the irony of that, too, because solitary confinement is supposed to be you're by yourself.
Right.
And this is just the exact opposite of that level of torture, where it's like, no, instead we're going to pack 10 men in here, and it's going to be equally, if not more, torturous.
And they know exactly what's going to happen.
Right.
It's almost, yeah, like they hope that they all kill each other,
right,
is what they're going for. They're like, well, we have an overcrowding problem, so if we do this, they know people are going to die.
Yeah.
And for them, that's probably a good thing, because they've got an overcrowding problem. Well, again, this prison ran for nearly 100 years, but it was eventually shut down in 1990 due to overcrowding and, of course, the poor conditions that were highlighted in a prisoner class action lawsuit against the prison.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, I didn't either.
A prisoner class action lawsuit by the prisoners. That's crazy. I didn't know they had that level of...
I wonder if it was by prisoners that were released,
or
did they actually, like, get this formed while they were still incarcerated?
Right, that's a good question.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure.
The last inmate was removed on December 31st, 1990, and it was never used as a prison after that again. Nearly 154,000 inmates had passed through OSR during its operation, and from disease, suicide, and murder, over 200 people died there. Many were buried in the prison cemetery just beyond the prison walls, and two of the 200 deceased included two guards who were killed during escape attempts. On November 2nd, 1926, a paroled inmate who had been returned to prison, ended up shooting 72-year-old prison guard Urban Wilford in an unsuccessful escape attempt. The murderer, Philip Orlek, who was arrested 2 months later, was then executed in the electric chair. On October 2, 1932, a 48-year-old prison guard named Frank Hanger was beaten to death with an iron bar during an escape attempt by 12 prisoners. Two of the inmates, Merrill Chandler and Chester Probasky, were found guilty of the murder, and both were executed in the electric chair in 1935, which the electric chair,
brutal,
like a whole other level.
Yeah. Have you seen The Green Mile?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a disturbing scene. It's a very disturbing scene. Wet the sponge, you know? Mm-hmm. These weren't the only murders in connection to the OSR, and on one tragic day, July 21st, 1948, two former inmates who were named John West and Robert Daniels kidnapped the prison's farm superintendent and his family. So the OSR had a program where basically well-behaved prisoners could work on their prison farms, and sometimes these were called honor farms. Not horror farms, as we might basically is a horror farm, but these were typically on properties separate from the prison complex, so it's most likely the prisoners would wake up, then they would get shuttled over to these farms where they would work for probably dirt cheap, and then they would be shuttled back to the prison at night. So the former inmate John West was often described as a, quote, moron, and his accomplice Robert Daniels was described as having a, quote, psychopathic personality. They had become friends while sharing an OSR cell, and they bonded over their common interests of crime and chaos. Robert Daniels was later quoted during an interview saying, quote, "We love drinking, robbing, and hitting on girls." So they were actually paroled about 1 year apart, and they met up again in early July 1948. And while they were getting drunk together, they decided, hey, why not just go on a crime spree? Yeah, these were free men at the time. They were paroled, but they could have just done anything else, but I guess they were just addicted to crime. The first attack was when they walked into Earl Ambrose's tavern on Fifth Avenue, and they shot the owner dead and wounded a woman before fleeing the scene. On another drunken night, they recalled all the OSR guards that had ever wronged them, and they fantasized about what they would do to them if they ever got the chance at revenge. They decided the worst of all the guards was a man named Willis Harris, who went by the nickname Red, and he became their next target. Only 2 weeks after murdering the tavern owner, they headed back to the OSR area near the Honor Farms to look for Red, but they ended up getting lost, and they ended up at a house of John Nibles, who was an Honor Farm supervisor. They missed Red's house by a short distance and mistook it for Nibles, and by the time the two men got inside John's house, they just said, screw it, we don't really care who the next victim is, they just wanted revenge. They kidnapped John, his wife Phyllis, and their 20-year-old daughter and took them out into the farm fields. The two men then forced the family on their knees, put a gun to each of their heads, and fired. Allegedly, Robert Daniels murdered each of them as John West walked. So Van Wert County police were on high alert after this, and during a routine traffic stop, the men were confronted by an officer. They'd been driving a stolen truck, and during the stop, Robert remained calm, but John's nervous demeanor kind of tipped the officer off. He's like, well, I don't know why this guy's acting so suspicious during just a routine check here. As he headed back to his squad car, John, from the car seat, pulled a gun and opened fire at the officer. Robert took cover inside the truck, and according to him, he did not fire a weapon. As police backup arrived, a shootout lasted several minutes. John ended up shooting a police sergeant, who then fell to the ground and returned fire, and that sergeant's bullet struck John West directly in the head, finally ending this shootout. Robert Daniels, who was unarmed, was then arrested. The local news dubbed these men, quote, the Mad Dog Killers, and Robert confessed to the crimes, was found guilty, and sentenced to death. So in an interview with Robert, he said, quote, I just wanted Red. I'm sorry the wife and daughter had to die. There was no rope to tie them up. After my score was settled with Red, I'd be ready to die. I haven't got it settled, but guess I'll die anyhow. Because if you remember, he did not kill Red. He mistook the house and just killed a random farm superintendent. He then winked at the camera after saying this, and 6 months later, on January 3rd, 1949, Robert Daniels was executed by the electric chair.
So clearly no rehabilitation going on.
No, that dude's smug as hell.
Just pissed off inmates that, you know, want a revenge no matter what. It's sad that an innocent family had to die over right. these two. Then the next year, there was another tragic death at the OSR. The warden's wife, Helen Glatke, was in the family quarters when she accidentally shot herself in November 1950. She had been getting ready for church and reaching for a jewelry box in her bedroom closet. When she pulled the box, it knocked her husband's loaded pistol from its hiding place, and as it hit the ground, it discharged, wounding her. She initially survived but died in the hospital 3 days later from pneumonia brought on by a wound. And 9 years later, the warden, Arthur, died from a heart attack in his office at the reformatory. In the administration wing, where the warden's office and family quarters are, visitors believe the spirits of Helen and Arthur still remain. Near the pink bathroom, Helen's personal bathroom, the smell of faint roses lingers. Some believe this was because Helen often wore a rose perfume or often supplied the bathroom with fresh roses. Her apparition has also been seen heading into the bathroom on several occasions. Others have experienced digital cameras that freeze up or film cameras that jam until they leave the family quarters. And in the summer months, this area in the administration wing has very little ventilation and it gets very hot. Regardless, visitors have felt sudden cold spots even on the hottest of days. It's important to note Theodore Glatke's opinion on the hauntings, as he's a son of Helen and Arthur, and he was raised in the family quarters. In an interview, he said this, "I find it hard to think a spirit stays in a place rather than with loved ones. Haunting a house is a concept left over from when people died where they were born. I have little respect for ghost stories, all the inaccurate pieces and sensationalism regarding their lives. This is why many believe their spirits are not trapped there. Instead, they might be residual energy or psychic impressions left behind, which we've talked about many times on the show. They might just be a recording of emotionally charged events imprinted upon our world. And as we've talked about before, sometimes these are called vertical after images. But whatever it is, it's drawn countless people to the OSR in recent years. The prison has been featured on countless paranormal shows, including World's Scariest Places. It was also used as a shooting location for the movies like Tango and Cash, Air Force One, and of course, The Shawshank Redemption. After filming The Shawshank Redemption, the state demolished all of the outbuildings and the prison wall, but the main buildings have remained untouched. The state government considered using it to expand the Mansfield Correctional Institute, a new state prison that opened nearby in 1990, but the land was turned over to a preservation group in 1995. The interior stayed almost exactly the same since the mid-1900s, and the six-story cell block still holds the record for the largest freestanding steel cell block in the world. So let's talk about some of the hauntings that people claim to experience here.
So this reformatory has been a hotspot for paranormal activities for decades, and even skeptics have claimed that the chapel specifically and the infirmary feel heavy. It's kind of all, this is a common thing you experience in a paranormal area. And the wind often brings this unnerving moaning sound through the cell blocks, which also unsettles people. Even during daylight hours, visitors have heard their names called out from restricted areas. Cupboard doors open and close on their own. Strange noises of movement come from rooms that should be completely still. The chapel is known to be one of the most active areas in the OSR, and rumors claim that long before this section of the prison became a holy place, it was actually used for electric chair executions. Who thought of that remodel idea?
Yeah, seriously.
Like the state used to execute people in here. Now let's turn it into a holy place?
I mean, it would make sense. There'd be vertical after images in this place, though.
Seriously. Visitors have felt grasping hands while they try to leave the area. Others have felt like they're being watched even during the daytime. Disembodied voices have also been heard, which might be the echoes of the death row inmates' final words. Today, the room is mostly empty. The paint along the walls is basically peeling away, but some of the religious artwork still remains, which also gives it this eerie feeling to it. Rumor has it that down in the subterranean floor of the prison, a 14-year-old boy was once beaten to death. The death was never technically documented, but the boy's shadow can be seen flickering along the walls out of the corner of your eye. He's always trying to escape through the doors, but he always fails, and this energy from the boy is light and non-aggressive. He doesn't seem like an evil spirit, but there is a spirit down there, supposedly an old guard, that emits more of a sinister energy. And this spirit is believed to be the boy's murderer, and the two of them are at odds with each other forever, one always chasing the other, but it's just forever, I guess. An imprint of some time before. So back in the large cell block, which is huge, by the way, if you're listening, maybe pull up a picture of it. It's phenomenally large. But in this large cell block, multiple tragedies have occurred. An inmate named Larry Hamer was scheduled for a prison transfer. The week before he was moved, he tied his bedsheets to a cell railing on one of the upper floors of the cell block, tied the other end around his neck, and hanged himself. Another inmate named James Lockhart had been sentenced to 15 years in 1960 at the age of 22. He covered himself in turpentine that he stole from the prison furniture shop and set himself on fire inside his cell. It's believed that his spirit still haunts cell number 13 on the fourth floor. Visitors and guards have witnessed an apparition of the man on fire inside the cell, and when he's not self-immolating, the spirit is not very talkative, but some claim they can communicate with him through movements, possibly just picked up by dowsing rods, which, I don't know, how do you feel about dowsing rods?
For being honest, pretty skeptical.
Yeah.
I've never, like, seriously tried using them before, but I've definitely seen other people use them and
same
videos of other people using them. I'm not quite sure, like, exactly how they work. I know it's like using your intuition and your, you know, some people claim you're accessing that, you know, the Akashic records, you know, you're kind of using it. I know some people use it for, I was watching one video, a family was using dowsing rods for locating a water well.
Yeah, it's for underground things.
Yeah,
that was its original use. I could be wrong about that, but I swear it was for finding things underground was like why dowsing rods were originally to be used, and like finding certain metals.
Right.
Like, ooh, there might be a gold mine somewhere here. Like prospectors would maybe try and use them, but yeah, I think I don't trust them at all. Anything where it's just one person holding it and manipulating it, I'm like, I don't know about like that one.
Could it be their hands moving it, right? You know, like subtly? I don't know. Definitely skeptical, but also open at the same time. I'm sure there's people that are legit that know how to use them and have like proven that they work. You know what I mean? Like they've had success with them. So
if you have found a water well,
yeah, that's
a place to get
a win.
That's huge.
That's a win.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
In another section of the prison, there's the chair room. This is one of the only rooms in the reformatory with no windows, and a single chair sits in the center. As the legend goes, if you move the chair away from the center, it will eventually find its way back to the original position all on its own. I live to see something like this happen.
Same.
Like set an object down in a supposedly haunted room, walk away, and then I go back and I'm like, there's no way anybody else came in there and it's moved. That's pretty wild.
Oh, we need to get lights out crew in a
I need to just prison. Get like a camera set up in here.
Yeah, actually.
Like seriously, and just see if anything happens in here. Let's just have a 24/7 recording.
Maybe you just should. Watch me sleeping.
Yeah, exactly. The whole time. Yeah, that might not be good. But for whatever reason, the dark entity residing here hates having the chair anywhere but in the very center of the room. During one ghost hunt, An investigator sat in the chair and began provoking the spirit, screaming names at it and insulting it. According to the ghost hunter, they were then pushed out of the chair and scratched by an invisible force inside of this chair room. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a crazy powerful spirit.
Anytime there's a physical attack, it's pretty wild.
But yet nobody's died.
Nobody's
still
died.
Still to this day. They don't have the ability to kill somebody yet. But that we know of. Yeah, that we know of, right? But definitely scratches is a fairly common thing. And this investigator had a long wound running down their back. The other notorious spot for paranormal activity is near the solitary confinement cells, which honestly makes a lot of sense. Countless visitors have reported feeling cold spots, feeling nauseous, and the sensation of being watched. The spirit of an inmate who died in the hole is believed to haunt the area, reliving his final tormented hours. And many say this area has the most consistent paranormal activity in the entire prison. Many people still visit the OSR to this day. This 2024 Halloween season, the OSR will host a haunted house attraction called the Blood Prison Experience.
Sign me up.
That sounds insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like an ideal place to have a haunted attraction, right? Is somewhere actually haunted.
Yeah, it already has that history element to it. So people are going in ready to be scared.
True, true. Besides visitors and tour guides during the off season, the prison is mostly desolate. But the paranormal activity and dark history still fill those empty rooms. Even skeptics who don't believe in ghosts say the tour is worth it for the history alone. And the complex stands as a glimpse into the very dark past of U.S. incarceration.
But I always think of that. It's like, it's horrific in multiple levels. You know, if you believe in ghosts, it's terrifying that way. But it's also just terrifying considering the history of the building.
Just all the real horrible things that went on there.
Right. But next up is the West Virginia Penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia, which operated as a prison from 1866 to 1995. That's well over a century.
We were babies.
Yeah.
This thing was still operating.
Yeah. It was constructed since West Virginia didn't have proper resources after the state seceded from Virginia, and they had local courthouse holding cells and county jails that could temporarily hold inmates. And even though many had pushed for a proper state prison, it would only happen when 9 inmates escaped from the local jails all at once. And seeing that these local jails weren't enough, the people of West Virginia finally decided to build a massive prison. And much of the labor, of course, came from the future inmates themselves. Which, man, to unpack that, do you think that's ethical?
I think it's hard because I think, well, is it better that they be doing something and like stimulating their mind or just be cooped up all day? I feel like working is a good thing. And I feel like, why not use inmates to do, you know, a lot of the things that need to get done? You know, the roads are often a mess. There's littering everywhere. And I know they have programs, release programs, work release programs that they do that.
Yeah.
But like forcibly making them work, essentially slave labor, I think is definitely probably crossing the line. And if you're going to use them, like give them something to work for, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like they're either, if they're going to do this work, then, you know, give them something, whether it's a reduction of time or pay them in some way.
Right.
I know there, what's really interesting is the prison volunteer firefighters that go and fight the wildfires. There's a couple groups that they're inmates and they volunteer to go and fight the wildfires out in California. Yeah, there's a whole show on that that I watched, and that was pretty interesting.
Yeah,
actually,
that's a
really
noble,
cool,
noble job to do.
Totally, yeah. So yeah, I think it's good to give them. I think it's better that they do something than nothing.
Yeah,
but
to have purpose in your day to day, I agree. But yeah, if you're forcing them to do that, and I mean, that's the big contention with the 13th Amendment. It freed the slaves, but and at the same time, it has the clause in there where it says like, oh, except if you're incarcerated for being convicted for a crime, slavery can still technically be legal. And I know that's been a big back and forth with law and Congress to be like, should we remove that clause? Because we're essentially saying, oh, slavery is no more except
right.
in this circumstance. So that's my gripe with it, which, you know, to say that it is slavery is like, maybe
I wouldn't
incorrect.
Equate it to the same.
Right. Yeah. So it's not the same thing. There is a distinction, but it is close and it is worrisome.
Like, at least if you're going to make them work, like, make sure they're fed well and they get the hydrate, like, don't torture them through the labor.
Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. I always think of like the chain gangs, like making the railroads and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah, this doesn't seem right. This seems like straight up forced labor for an inmate.
Well, who's ultimately benefiting, right? Yeah. There's people that are reaping the profits from that. And, you know, you're using that loophole to not have to pay for labor to do it. And it's like they're exploiting, not only exploiting the prisoners, but then they're also exploiting the people who are not prisoners that could be working those jobs and making money for their families from it. So
it's a good point too.
You know, yeah. It's greed at the end of the day.
It is. Yeah. But woof, that is a episode in and of itself. But back to the West Virginia penitentiary. It was also built just behind a Native American burial ground. Apparently it's the Grave Creek Mound Historical Site. And the city of Moundsville even got its name in honor of the many burial grounds in that region. And many of these were built by, including the Grave Creek Mound Historical Site, by the Adena people. And this was more than 2,000 years ago. That is wild to think about. This prison is also called Moundsville for short, which it will be maybe flip-flopping between Moundsville and West Virginia Penitentiary here. Just so nobody gets confused. But like many other prisons during this time, it was built in that Gothic style, tall sandstone structures. They even had scaled down turrets and battlements. So it legit looks like a castle. And its walls were 24 feet high and 6 feet thick at the base. I mean, this could legitimately be used as a castle.
A fortress, yeah.
Prison officials once described the prison saying, quote, "The architecture exhibited as much as possible great strength and conveyed to the mind a cheerless blank indicative of the misery which awaits the unhappy being who enters within its walls." This is concerning to me because this is basically admitting whoever comes here, they're going to be miserable and we're going to make it so.
But shouldn't prison be miserable?
I mean, it's funny because like we go to the other ones where the Eastern State Penitentiary, which is another big one, they have these vaulted ceilings and they're all like Reformation, return to God. Like it has that, which I don't know if that was just a facade in general. It was fake. But then here they're just admitting, no, you come here to be in misery. So it's like, whoa, that's a stark difference from what some of the other ones were built for.
So you're not a fan of the inconsistency?
Yeah, I mean, look, I know terrible people are going through these systems. Like, that's the reality of a prison a lot of the times. But I think it's a bit gross for the prison officials to just be like, we built this to subject these people to misery. Sure. I think that's wild. Sure. It's like he's not even trying to portray it as a place to be rehabilitated.
Right.
He's just being like, nope, you come in here, a cheerless blank indicative of the misery which awaits the unhappy being who enters within its walls. I don't know. That's pretty bold. That's dark.
Yeah. I agree. I agree with that. It's just, you know, you have such a wide range of individuals coming through, right? And does everybody deserve this sort of treatment, you know, looping, you know, or lopping everybody together.
Right.
Like maybe, you know, you have some of the worst, you know, evil individuals there, but then you got people there who could be there because they're wrongfully accused or even, you know, petty crimes, things like that, things that aren't quite as serious. They didn't like take somebody else's life. They didn't physically harm somebody and yet they're still subjected to the same conditions, right?
Exactly.
And that's the difficult thing with just the whole prison topic as a whole.
It needs,
I mean, hasn't been reformed all that much from these early days, it seems like.
No, we've tried to, but man, still stuck in its ways in a lot of cases. But
and then don't even mention the private prisons.
Oh, God.
Prisons for profit.
For profit.
You know, like, yeah. It's a whole industry now, so, yeah.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Anyways.
Lot to unpack. That could be an entirely other Lights Out episode.
To pose a broader hypothetical to you two, just for the sake of some variety, do you feel the same way, though, about prisons that are intentionally made, though, with no qualms about the treatment you're getting, like, i.e. something like a supermax prison, where, like, you're only going there because you are definitively the worst of the worst kind of person? Do you still feel that it should be rehabilitation focused? Or do you think that at a point that you've committed a crime large enough to be sent to a supermax, that you've just voided your right as a human being?
Ooh.
I will just say, I don't think anybody can void their right as a human being. Blanket statement. I think everyone at the end of the day is a human being. As despicable and as disgusting as people can be, to dehumanize one another is just terrifying to me. And that's how we get fascism. That's how terrible things are subjected to each other when we start to dehumanize one another. So I don't know. I don't think I can unpack a supermax prison, but I do know at the end of the day, these are other human beings. And I think it's more of a reflection of how we treat them. They may have done terrible things, but man, when we go to subject them to just torture at the end of the day, what does that make us? And we're all involved in this. We're all taxpayers, right? We all fund a lot of this, except, you know, here and there, it's not always, but these are prisoners of the state, of the country. So they are our responsibility. And I think I can, in good conscience, just subject people to torture.
Which, I mean, is a supermax prison torturing people?
Some of them are, like, speaking of the scariest prisons ever, I think, yeah, some of those are.
Well, I mean, just so, like, before Josh gives his version of the answer, like, we have one here in Colorado, Florence or whatever. And, like, I've sent pictures to, like, Austin and Daniel before in, like, group chats before. Like, it's a pretty frightening place.
Yeah.
Like, even if you want to make the argument of, like, it's clean and it's, you know, it's built for the intent of housing the worst of the worst, when you look at the way that it's built, it's like something out of, like, a, like, cult horror movie. It's like it is frighteningly built with the intent of dehumanization.
Yeah.
And it's been around for a while too, and that's the thing, is I think, are we doing everything the best we possibly can? No. I think it's difficult, because it's easier to have the perspective you do if you've never been affected by somebody like this. You know what I mean? Like, if you put yourself, say, in one of the victim's shoes of one of these individuals in Supermax or a family member of somebody that was murdered or killed by somebody in there. I think, and maybe not, I mean, just might be everybody's, you know, got a different perspective on, you know, life and just
forgiveness,
right? Everybody's got, I think it's difficult to say universally one way or the other, right? I think, yeah, it just comes down to people's personal beliefs. I think from my perspective, I would have a very difficult time knowing that if one of my family members' killers was in a rehabilitative facility where their quality of life maybe even improved from when they were outside of prison, I think I might have a hard time dealing with that, because, you know, I'm over here dealing with the trauma and the memories and, you know, missing the person that was lost, and this individual seemingly, you know, maybe they're, you know, maybe they're conflicted still and they're still dealing with it, but they're also being treated in a way that is allowing them to maybe escape having to relive some of those memories. So
yeah,
for me, it's, I think it's a difficult question. I think it could be improved across the board. And I think at the very least, every human deserves basic human rights, no matter who you are. You know, you shouldn't be subjected to torture per se, right?
Yeah, that's where I'm drawing the line.
Yeah.
Some people do need to be in prison forever. That is just a fact. My qualms is more with dehumanizing people,
sure,
who have done horrific things. I think that's where it becomes problematic.
Yeah. Well, then it's like, why would you even do it at that point? What, you know, then maybe they should just be executed at that point. What's right, the point of keeping them alive and dehumanize them? Yeah. Then is there any true purpose to that?
Right.
Or
right.
Is it just because that's what they've always done?
Right.
And so I think it needs to be overhauled at some point, and it'll be interesting to see where we go with crime and punishment and the prison system in the future, and also with technology. I feel like technology could aid us in more ways than one with the prison system, from both a security standpoint and also a way of enriching, you know, trying to reform and rehabilitate people through the use of technology. And especially, you know, and I'm specifically thinking more so along the lines of understanding the brain and, you know, devices like Neuralink. And, you know, I think we're going to make a lot of discoveries in the next 50 years on why people are the way that they are. Yeah. And hopefully we can find better ways to rehabilitate people based on their brain chemistry and understanding the brain better, and maybe prevent them from getting worse. But I don't think it should be. I really am conflicted, because you watch, I think it's Michael Moore's film, where he goes over to Sweden or something like that.
Oh, and, I haven't seen that.
Oh, you should see that. Tom, you'll have to look up what that, I'm trying
they
to
all got like it. TVs and shit in there.
Yeah, well, stuff. They go, he goes to a prison over there, and killers, people who have murdered people in cold blood, are not confined to their cell all day. They are allowed to cook with knives and function as a normal human. And I think it shows a lot of promise in the rehabilitation of people, of like, you treat somebody like a human being, and they're allowed to go outside and like walk freely around the grounds, mm-hmm, and stuff. And based on what we saw in the film, it seems like it's working, right? I just have a hard time computing that. I think that's great, but I have a hard time computing that with, what about the victim's family, yeah, member, and, yeah, how do they feel about that? And that, right, never seems to get brought up. And so
that's why I think it's really important to take the families or the victim's,
right,
families or,
right,
friends, the close relatives or whatever, into account when you're sentencing, and totally, what is to be done. I think absolutely that has to be taken into account. Those, because, are the ones, yeah, affected, right?
Well, they have to ultimately move on with their life and figure out how to heal.
Yeah.
And some people aren't going to be able to have that forgiveness to just be like, I think he should, you know, be reformed and rehabilitated. I think some people are like, I hope this person fucking dies. I hope they, yeah, suffer. And I hope they experience the same type of death that my loved one did. Right. And so I see both sides. And, yeah, because, yeah, some victims are like, I forgive this person. And ultimately, I had to forgive them in order to start healing myself, because if you're just harboring all this hate and...
Yeah, my aunt was a part of a prison program where they facilitated like face-to-face interactions. Depending on the case, they didn't do certain cases like this, but they would do victims' families interacting with prisoners and so on and so forth. And the whole idea was to facilitate forgiveness at the end of the day. And often people mistake, they think that forgiveness means that like we're forgive and forget, this never happened. Right. But that's not what forgiveness is, and that it's more like moving on. How do we move on from this? This has happened. It has fundamentally changed our lives forever. So what do we do with this? And it's opening up discourse, and it's remembering what happens and trying to move forward. And that's how I think of those programs, as like trying to get to move somewhere to a better place for the victims.
But if that person's never going to see the light of day again, is there even a point? You know what I mean? Like, can they, like,
for the victims' families, I think there is. Even if the prisoner gets nothing out of that, I think, yeah, I think it's worth it for the victims' families who want to maybe come to some, not understanding, but something within themselves. You know, I think that discourse can maybe open something up.
Totally, which I think is easier said than done too, right?
Absolutely.
I think
it's
depending on the circumstances.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is why it's like some cases, they don't even facilitate certain cases.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, this was just too horrific and the family doesn't want anything to do with it. So it's more like the family can reach out and be like, hey, if this inmate is willing, maybe we can do something.
Right, if it's mutual, yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. We can't solve it here.
No,
it's
no.
Too fucked. It's
no.
Too fucked.
It's just been going on for so long. It's one of the many systemic issues in our country. It's just the prison system has not evolved with the times, and I think there's a lot of simple things we could do to improve the quality of life for prisoners, at least when it comes to basic necessities that would perhaps, and that's what's interesting about this show Unlocked, you should watch, is it's kind of like testing out a new idea to see if we give them a little bit more freedom, if we give them some more rights, can they,
how do they operate?
And I worry because I think, are we too far gone? Are we too far past the point of no return, that even if we did progress our the way that we treat prisoners and rehabilitate them, is it even possible? Like, maybe for a few it could be, but for the masses, especially people who have reoffended, is it even possible at that point? Because then you get them rehabilitated, then they come and deal with the issues outside of prison. And then it's like, then there's a whole other layer of complexity there. I don't know.
This is above my pay grade. That's for sure. I do not know how to solve this. All I know is that we shouldn't dehumanize one another. That's the only blanket statement I can provide here, which is I might be a coward because it's not really a hot take. That's all I can provide here. I didn't study criminal justice. It's hard to, but this is the discussion that some people might be like, they're yapping. Why can't they just shut up and get back to the story? But I think this is what these stories kind of bring up. This is,
totally.
We're looking at the history of prisons, and the hauntings are a part of it. It's all intertwined. And sometimes these are the conversations that happen because of these stories, you know?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, back to the architecture, which is where we left off. Even with its strong defensive exterior, prison escape attempts were common, and within these walls, inmates were subjected to extreme violence and unsanitary conditions. Fights, gambling, and riots just had become a way of life inside Moundsville, and this prison quickly got a bad reputation. During its run, 998 men died within its walls. In its early days, it was seen as a prison focused on the true reform of its inmates, and this is where the word comes from. This is why it was dubbed a penitentiary, because the word penitent implies the inmates would have sorrow and regret for their wrongdoings. Many of the times they would reform, turn to God.
Which is like interesting that from the very beginning, that was the goal.
The goal, yeah, yeah.
You know, and even now, I think a lot of people would say that they, when they found God in prison, it changed their life.
Yeah, yeah.
Or helped them get through the years they served.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, and it makes you think like spirituality is a very important aspect. And of course, you know, from the beginning, it was, you know, the Christian faith is the one that, you know, it's typically, not like they're being like, if you want to go to the mosque, we've got that available as well. That's not an option,
right?
Especially in the early days.
Yeah. Speaking of, it reminds me of the film Denzel Washington was in that was about the hurricane, who was a boxer who was falsely convicted of murder. He converted to Islam in prison.
Right.
So it is a common theme. People do reach out to some higher being and to religion to kind of cope with their circumstances.
Which I think is great, by the way.
Yeah.
I think if there's a somewhere you're going to do soul searching, it'd probably be prison, right?
Yeah,
you
for
know,
sure.
After you've just been put away for something that you did.
Absolutely.
And a lot of prisoners turn to religion and spirituality for guidance and answers, and oftentimes it does help them rehabilitate. So.
Yeah. But you are right, a lot of them were Christian oriented.
Right.
Back in
the day.
They
didn't give people options.
Yeah. I think it was rare. I think maybe Eastern State. I believe they had a small temple inside Eastern State Penitentiary, but it was mostly Christian oriented.
It's usually a chapel, right?
Yeah. So yeah, they would, you know, try and reform and turn to God. But as it turned out, you know, this system wasn't much of an improvement from earlier systems in the 1800s. Which, I mean, it gets scarier the further you go back. But in the beginning, 251 men were the original inmates at Moundsville. They were offered jobs as part of the reformation process. They worked in the prison bakery, had the hospital, and a blacksmith shop. A library and classes were also available to the inmates. And for a short while, the prison conditions and inmate behavior were pretty positive all around, but this would soon come to an end. Facilities began to crumble by the mid-1900s, conditions worsened, sanitation was almost forgotten. Just like the OSR, overcrowding made all the problems way worse. Three prisoners were placed in a 5x7-foot cell. This is even way smaller
than...
This
is a closet.
Yeah, because if you remember, the OSR had 7x9. This is 5x7. Way smaller. Two were placed in bunk beds, and one was placed either on the floor or in a separate cot against a different wall. And vermin and cockroaches also occupied these cells. Large rats invaded the prison kitchen and cafeteria. Some claim the vermin and rats were so bold, they even began stealing inmates' food right off their plates. So as these conditions worsened, the inmates lashed out at the guards and other inmates, and Moundsville was soon ranked as one of the top 10 most violent U.S. prisons. Much of the violence happened in what's called the Sugar Shack, and this is the prison rec room. This room is known for illegal gambling, drug deals, sexual assault, fighting, and even murder. Today, in the Sugar Shack, disembodied voices can be heard arguing, unexplained noises and cold spots are witnessed, and there's just an overall uneasy feeling that's experienced by many of the visitors here. 36 reported homicides took place while the prison was in operation, and at least one of these victims is known to haunt the basement area.
And then in 1979, a 57-year-old inmate named R.D. Wall, and sometimes it's spelled Walls in news articles, but he had been sentenced to life in prison for rape. He worked in the penitentiary as a maintenance clerk, and over the years he became popular among the other inmates, but mostly kept to himself and quietly served his time. A group of transferred inmates would soon disrupt his peace, though. R.D. Wall tried to get along with everyone in the prison. This included the prison guards. The transfers noticed R.D.'s buddy-buddy attitude with the guards, and they had a problem with it. Laughing with the guards like they were old friends was a red flag to the transfers. In their circle, only snitches spoke with the guards like they were friends, and they believed R.D. was feeding the guards information about the other inmates. So one day in 1979, the new transfer inmates hid inside one of the bathrooms in the basement area of the penitentiary. They each held a dull shiv that they had made from toothbrushes or glass shards wrapped in fabric. R.D. was on his way to the boiler room to fetch some cleaning supplies, and the men hiding in the bathroom made sure to listen for other voices or footsteps to make sure he was alone before they jumped him. They then dragged him into the bathroom, pushed him to the ground, and one of the men grabbed R.D.'s hand. The others were pinning him down. The man holding his hand then sliced off each of R.D.'s fingertips. Then he stabbed the shiv into the palm of his hand between the bones. And then another man stabbed R.D. in the neck, pushing hard to get the dull shiv to pass through his skin. When the guards later found R.D.'s body had been shoved into one of the bathroom stalls, his head had almost been completely severed from his neck. State police soon arrived to the prison to investigate. After other inmates saw the officers and caught wind of what happened, several fights broke out. Three other inmates were injured to the point that they needed to be hospitalized, and another prisoner was placed in solitary confinement. Dick Mon, the prison superintendent, was later quoted by the local newspaper saying, quote, "The institution is under control. It was never out of control."
Okay. Of course. Yeah, thanks.
Today, many believe the ghost of R.D. Wall remains in the basement area, especially near the bathroom and the boiler room. Several reports of ghost activity by countless visitors have been documented throughout the years. The spirit is apparently obsessed with women. Many visitors have felt fingers running through their hair. Sometimes the fingers seem too short, like the tips have been cut off. Others feel a slight pressure on their cheeks, like the stroke of a hand. Footsteps can also be heard, especially while standing in the bathroom. The footsteps often head down into the basement toward the boiler room in the same pattern and direction as R.D. walked, moments before his murder. His voice can also be heard, but it's often too muffled to make out any words. On rare occasions, an apparition has been seen, a man wearing an all-khaki maintenance uniform, walking to the boiler room. Some have even followed him, only to turn a corner and find themselves all alone. Others find him standing there without a head. That's insane. Imagine seeing a headless apparition.
That's creepy.
Other inmates who died here died at the hands of the state. 85 men were executed at the penitentiary during its operation. One was a man named Elmer Bruner, the last person legally executed in West Virginia on April 3, 1959. Elmer had been convicted of killing 58-year-old Ruby Miller. On May 27, 1957, he had bludgeoned her to death with the claw end of a hammer. He was arrested the same day and confessed, but later claimed his innocence. Both his appeals were rejected post-conviction, and within the last day of his execution, he was kept in a cell several feet away from Old Sparky, as Old Sparky was the nickname given to Moundsville's infamous electric chair. On his execution day, he was strapped into the chair and then electrocuted to death. He became the ninth and last inmate to be executed by Old Sparky between 1951 and 1959. The execution cap that was worn in the chair is now in the archive of the afterlife at the Sanford Center, a museum of hauntings in Cameron, West Virginia. Many who have come into contact with the cap claim they get a strong feeling of anxiety, maybe because it's an executioner's cap.
Yeah.
At the prison, some have witnessed strange paranormal sightings near what was called the Death House, and this was the building that once held death row inmates in four cells before their executions. It's no longer there, but visitors have seen strange lights near the area at night. Many believe these lights are the sparks of electricity, or spectral remnants of the old electric chair, or Old Sparky.
Old Sparky. Before they even used Old Sparky, the state used to execute its inmates by hanging. This was a very conventional method back then. One of the most infamous hangings was of a man named Frank Heyer on June 6, 1931. His execution would mark the end of the public executions in West Virginia, and for very good reason. Frank had been convicted of murdering his wife, Eva Heyer, after he beat her to death inside his restaurant in December 1930. He then barricaded himself inside the restaurant as the police surrounded him. He fired his handgun, but only as a warning shot, according to him, and he was eventually arrested without anyone else getting hurt. During his trial, he blamed alcohol for his actions and said he didn't remember any of his actions that day. He was then convicted and sentenced to hang. So this was, when was Prohibition? This must have been somewhere around there.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming he's maybe using that hype of Prohibition, that he's trying to blame it on alcohol rather than take responsibility here. In his final moments, as he was led out of his holding cell and ushered toward the gallows, he thanked the priest beside him for the, quote, wonderful Christian experience. He had previously been suicidal on death row, but said that the church had brought him back. And he said, quote, it made me a good man. Take that as you will. On his walk to the gallows on the north end of the prison, he confessed his crime over and over, claiming that, quote, whiskey caused it. Just before he approached the execution area, he said, quote, meet me in heaven, and when you preach, Father, tell young men to leave the whiskey alone. They then placed the noose around his neck, and his last words were, quote, I'm guilty. I am perfectly willing to shed my blood for this crime. Jesus has saved my soul. I am not afraid to die. So the door beneath him gave way. If you're not familiar with how they used to hang people, they would take you up on a platform, put the rope around your neck, and then the floor would drop beneath you, and then you would hang. And usually you could see into it a lot of the times with these public executions.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So when that floor dropped, something went wrong, and the noose squeezed Frank's neck so hard that his body jerked on the way down, and the rope tore his head clean from his body.
Ooh.
This is why this was the last public execution here. Officials never admitted to his death being the cause, but I mean, you can kind of assume that's why they phased it out in West Virginia. And instead, they began using Old Sparky. Witnesses to this day have claimed to see a headless man walking around the old gallows area. The North Hall is another location of the prison that's become known for its hauntings, and this is where the worst offenders were placed in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. This is also where several reported murders took place. One was of William Red Snyder, Red being his nickname. He was a leader of the Aryan Brotherhood in the prison. He had been convicted of murdering his parents and mutilating their bodies. At Moundsville, Red was pretty disliked by almost everyone there, as you can imagine, and often got into physical altercations with the other inmates. And his last altercation was a fatal one. He was attacked as he was leaving his cell and stabbed 37 times. Paranormal events still plague this area near his cell to this day, including anomalies showing up later in photographs, equipment malfunctions, and the sound of cell doors banging when no one is there. The closer the visitors are to Red's cell, the more uncomfortable they feel, and his ghost is believed to haunt the shadows inside his small living quarters and just outside at the spot where he died. So here is some footage from local news of people who have experienced paranormal events in this prison.
May of 2004, a woman was staying the night at the pen. She heard a noise, saw a figure, and then captured something that now hangs in the museum.
There was a solid black shadow standing in front of this door, and it was looking right at her. It seemed to be transparent, and she said it actually looked down at the light on its chest, and it kind of looked back at her. As if that's not strange enough, she continues walking backwards in the hall, raised her Sony camera. She took one photograph, and thankfully she captured the shadow that we call the Shadow Man.
Jason, our tour guide, is a spirit enthusiast, you might say. One eerie night of 2012, Jason was walking the dark halls in the north wing, and something blocked the light from his flashlight, maybe the same solid black shadow, this time ready for a close-up.
A human-like figure, best I could describe, walked out sideways from cell 17. and kind of stared me down for about 5 seconds. And I froze in fear because I thought, I don't want to continue walking towards it. I don't want to turn my back on it. So a few moments later, I decided I'm going to walk out backwards. And the entire time I did that and I got out of sight around the corner, whatever that thing was still standing there staring at me.
Did you hear that? Jason, Dan, our cameraman, and I stood alone on the fourth floor, the former psych ward. We didn't make that sound, but if not us, then who?
The people that don't believe me, I tell them, I say, come spend the night here.
It's here. It's here.
I do like that description of the shadow figure moving out sideways. Like he's not walking
right
and then turning. Yeah. He's like, comes out sideways. Yeah, that's super creepy.
What do you think of that photo?
I don't know.
What do you think, Tom? Tom's a photographer. Okay. You think that photo's legit? She just like raised her Sony camera and took a picture and she captured that whole apparition?
So I have two very different short answers. One is the one that I would like to believe and one is the one that as somebody who has quote unquote gone into places I should not have gone into without a right to enter. I've done like a lot of like urban exploration around like Colorado specifically and a lot around Texas when I lived there.
Tom's admitting to committing crimes.
Yeah, I wouldn't be like totally surprised if there was somebody who was just kind of like trying to fuck with them or even somebody who's homeless who was kind of like fucking around in there.
Snuck in. Yeah.
Yeah. I think kind of the thing that, but like my more realistic answer is that, or I guess that is the realistic answer. The one that I would like to be true is that she did capture something that is like actually somewhat evident of something strange having happened. I think my only qualifier for that is that without knowing what settings her camera was on and if she had like a flash attachment or anything like that, it's kind of hard to like take her at her word for it, especially if it's like this is a local news station. I don't think she's rocking around in there with like a 10 grand Sony that like, you know, is normally used for low light stuff like this. So with that being said, though, with it being a cheaper camera, that maybe she just popped off a shot. It is kind of weird because you kind of have to like, especially when you're somewhere that dark, you have to compensate so much with external settings. Like you got to adjust your ISO, your exposure speed, your shutter speed, all that fun stuff that like, it's very difficult. Anybody with a camera can tell you it's very, very difficult to pop off a quick shot in a dark room and have it not look like just a mess of just smudge and movement.
Right.
That so is it is too genuinely clear. Super interesting that like she just raised her camera, popped off a shot in a low light setting, and that's how it looked. That's genuinely interesting. Like you just because again, you have to manually adjust so much for that.
Right. But, even the former explanation terrifies me. Yeah, somebody's just sneaking in there that shouldn't be there, and maybe some off limits areas also equally.
I do actually have like a short story. Like, so there's an old steel mill in Pueblo, Colorado. Yeah, you can still drive by it. It's like the building is still standing, but it's like the giant smokestacks and everything. And me and a buddy went and explored around there, and we were getting followed by, I'm pretty sure, like just a homeless person, or maybe it was a security guard or something like that. It is a very weird feeling. But I will say for someone who's personally experienced it, it's in like a really masochistic kind of way, almost more comforting that you're like, oh, it's just another person. It's nothing supernatural. But then there's that other part of your brain that kicks on where you're like,
but maybe.
Yes, this other thing is also physical. This other thing has the ability to hurt me.
Right? True. Right. Yeah. Which is scarier.
Yeah. I don't even know.
Yeah. I wonder too if like. Also would love to know more details on the distance at which she took that photo and where that figure was. Like, is it possible that's like a flash reflection of herself or somebody with her? I don't know. That's like pretty clear.
And the only, just to like discount that real quick, it wouldn't look like that if it was some sort of a flash reflection. In order for it to appear black like that would have to be some kind of like a really fucked up camera sensor. When you're adding any amount of light to something like that, it's never going to appear black.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like even somebody who's like very dark, like pigmented, like African American, like ebony, like level of like pigmentation.
You could say black.
It's okay. I'm aware of that, but I'm trying to be as like scientifically accurate as I can. But like even somebody with super dark skin, having like a sudden amount of exposure is still going to reflect. It's not going to abstract.
Whereas in that photo,
like it's actually like absorbing like exposure. That's not what the human body does.
Gotcha.
So,
well, probably the apparition.
I also like how that guy was like, hey, if you don't believe, just come and visit.
Yeah. Like, yeah, like might, that approach.
Yeah. Cause it makes me want to go to these places, check them out.
Well, and then they were like hearing some sound like randomly.
They heard something like shut or something like that, like a door.
I mean, of all the places, again, it seemed like this place would for sure have some activity going on.
Yeah. Man, I would love to stay overnight at a prison. I think this place, I did look it up. I think it was this one. You can stay overnight.
Is there like a hotel attached or is
no.
It's like just roam around all night?
I think they give you 6 hours.
Ah,
and I'm not sure when it starts and when it ends, but it is through the night. And but it costs like $1,000 or something to get the tour.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn. I wish we had somewhere like this here in Colorado.
I know.
We don't have anything like that. Should we reach out to Supermax?
I think it's got. I do not. That would be crazy going to Supermax. I think most of these, it's all East Coast because that's the oldest, you know, where they built
all
these
the old
things.
Shit is. Yeah. Yeah. That'd be cool though. Anyways, by the late 1900s, Moundsville had an atrocious reputation. In 1979, a mass prison escape ended in the death of an off-duty state trooper, Philip Kesner, just outside the prison walls. And by 1986, the prison had gotten even worse. It housed nearly 2,000 men, almost 10 times the initial amount. So it started at like 260-ish, and now we're at 2,000.
It's crazy.
Security was so overwhelmed that the prison had become known for its inmates successfully picking their cell door locks whenever they wanted, which that's very concerning.
Walking around whenever you want.
And that's what they did. They just roam around the halls freely. And conditions had gotten so bad, insects carried diseases through the prison. The plumbing was falling apart, leaking sewage and contaminating water, and the sickly prisoners were on the verge of a massive riot. So New Year's Day in 1986, inmates had had enough. Security was already thin across the entire prison, and now several more guards had the day off for the holiday. 20 inmates initiated their plan, and they called themselves The Avengers, of course.
Hilarious.
And their plan was to start at 5:30 p.m. That's when they stormed the cafeteria where 6 guards were stationed, taking them by surprise, and the Avengers tackled them, held knives to their throats, and cuffed the guards with their own handcuffs. A cafeteria worker also got caught in the mix. Several more hostages were taken, but none were harmed. And this marked the beginning of a 2-day riot and protest. 3 inmates would end up being killed. The rioters had nearly taken over the prison by day 2, and they promised to stop rioting only when their demands for better conditions were met. But the riot was disorganized, so the Avengers appointed a leader, an inmate named Danny Lehman, who wasn't part of the original 20 Avengers, to negotiate. The riot gained national attention, and Governor Arch A. Moore Jr. went to the penitentiary to talk with the inmates, and they agreed on a new list of rules and standards that the prison would put into action. One of the agreed upon negotiations was a brand new cafeteria. Over the years, the overcrowding was slowly solved by building more prisons, and by 1995, around 700 inmates occupied the prison, which this is a huge drop, right, from 2000. So, you know, things were getting better, it seemed. However, the real reason these changes were made was that West Virginia law deemed 5x7-foot prison cells cruel and unusual punishment in 1986.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty brutal. 5x7, you can barely walk in that area or work out.
Yeah, that's it.
This wasn't long after the infamous prison riot, and the penitentiary was eventually phased out within a decade. With the amount of death and abuse within these walls, Moundsville is considered one of the most haunted prisons in the U.S. to this day. Several popular ghost hunting teams have visited the penitentiary, including our favorites.
Our boys.
Our boys over at Ghost Adventures, baby, for season 1, episode 3. So we're going to the most haunted prison straight off the bat.
Yeah, right there. Episode 3.
Season 1, yeah.
Yeah.
And when they were there, they heard unexplained noises and witnessed apparitions moving through the north wall.
I actually watched this episode. It was a lot of fun. They also get like very cold spots, which was interesting, especially I think they were down in maybe more basement areas, but they were seeing their breath.
Damn.
Which was crazy.
Which is that from?
Might just be cold temps.
Paranormal energy or just, yeah. It's just fucking chilly cold down there, you know?
And Sam and Colby have also gone to West Virginia Penitentiary.
That's pretty sweet, man. Many have witnessed phantom footsteps, doors slamming on their own, mysterious lights, and voices coming through spirit boxes. But today, many of the original buildings still stand, and Moundsville is now used for guided tours, as you saw in the local news coverage, haunted house attractions, even an escape room, and overnight private paranormal investigations. If we ever get skilled enough, maybe we could do that, but we got a lot of work to do.
When I can figure out what the hell the gear is used for.
Yeah, we've got a lot of learning to do
before
we undertake something that crazy.
I also want maybe some lessons on how to communicate, because I feel like that's a big thing. Like, how do I reach out if there's something there? How do I do it without offending? How do I do it depending on what the spirit might be, who it might be? I need to do some research.
Can't just scream at them, Austin. Because that doesn't mean they're going to answer.
No. If anything, I might get a huge scratch on my back.
Exactly. So, yeah, there you have it. The two of the most haunted prisons in this country, and they're even darker histories. We want to know if any of you have been there. I'm sure some of you out there have visited these prisons. Maybe for a haunted house attraction, or maybe you've even stayed overnight.
That would be awesome.
That'd be sick. We'd love to hear your experiences. I mean, definitely going to, if ever make my way out to West Virginia, definitely going to stop in Moundsville.
Hell yeah.
Check out that prison, because it sounds really just interesting and cool to look at and experience firsthand. But we're going to go ahead and wrap up today's episode there. Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully you enjoyed this one. We'll be back with another spooky one for you next week. But until next time, lights out, everybody.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.